There's the big board, the 20 electoral votes from the state of Pennsylvania. We just got new metrics in.
The inauguration of a president celebrates a peaceful transition of power engineered by the American voters.
This is your life now. This is our election now. This is us. This is our country. It's real.
Hi, and welcome to another episode of the 45th. Dear listeners, this is Rabia Chaudhary, and this week I am going to be hosting alone. I'll be manning the ship by myself, although I have some amazing guests to help navigate the waters. My co-host and partner in crime, Susan Simpson, intrepid reporter investigator, is out solving another unsolved mystery, wrongful conviction, which is, you know, for those of you who follow us in our other lives, we do on the show Undisclosed. So good luck to her, and hopefully she'll be back next week. But this week, I've got two amazing guests on. And first, I want to start by welcoming back Wajahat Ali. Hey, Wajahat.
Hey, hey. And I miss Susan Auntie. Hopefully she comes back soon.
Susan will come back and kick your ass. But let me remind folks who you are. Wajahat Ali is a journalist, writer, lawyer, and award-winning playwright. He is a TV host, and he has been a consultant for the U.S. State Department. Wajahat actually helped launch Al Jazeera America Network as co-host of Al Jazeera America's The Stream, which was a great show. I used to love that. And it extended the conversation to social media and beyond. He was a national correspondent, political reporter, and social media expert for Al Jazeera America. He is also the Peabody-nominated producer of the series The Secret Life of Muslims, and inshallah, God willing, he soon will be a Peabody award-winning producer of that series. He's also the lead author and researcher of Fear, Inc., Roots of the Islamophobia Network in America, which I would argue was the publication that really put him on the national map and made him part of the national conversation. It's a fantastic report, still available online, and it is published through the Center for American Progress. So once again, Waj, thank you for joining us. Our listeners love having you.
No, thank you. That was, if I wasn't married, I could easily get two rishtas and dates off of that amazing introduction.
So yeah, I might consider
your check is in the mail, Rabia. Or let me Venmo you. The kids use the Venmo these days. So you're I'll Venmo you five bucks.
Find like a proposal for my daughter like that, I might take a second look at it too.
She's not kidding, listeners.
I'm actually not kidding. That's just how we roll. But anyway, that's a whole other conversation. All right. Our second guest this week, and I'm so, so excited to have him on the show because I've been trying and I think blackmailing him for a while to do this. And that is Mehdi Hassan. Now, let me first tell you about Mehdi before we get into conversation with him. Mehdi Hassan, first of all, if you are a British from the UK, you know Mehdi Hassan, period. He's been named as one of the 100 most influential Britons on Twitter. He is an award-winning British columnist, journalist. He is now based in Washington, D.C., and I'm thankful for that, but he is an Al Jazeera anchor. He's a contributing editor to The Statesman, a columnist with The Intercept, and also teaches at Georgetown University. In the past, he was a political director for Huffington Post UK, and he also, much to my chagrin and burning jealousy, has been named in the top 500 most influential Muslims in the entire world. Now, I have a story about how I first got to know Mehdi. Yes. Here's my story.
I know where this is going.
I have a lot of stories, but let me start with this one. I was watching a video on Facebook that was being shared like crazy. Everybody I was connected to was sharing this video of this guy in this debate, this Oxford University debate. And I was like, all right, fine. I guess I'll spend the 10 minutes to watch it, whatever, 20 minutes to watch it. And I was blown away. Do you remember that?
Mehdi single-handedly saved Islam on YouTube.
He did. It was incredible. So I want to first insert this clip.
What I find so amusing tonight is we're having a debate about Islam, and the opposition tonight have come forward. We have a graduate in law, a graduate in modern history, a graduate in chemistry. And, you know, I admire all of their intellects and their abilities, but we don't have anyone who's actually an expert on Islam, a scholar of Islam, a historian of Islam, a speaker of Arabic, even a terrorism expert or a security expert or a pollster, let alone to talk about what Muslims believe or think. Instead, we have people coming here, putting forward these views, putting forward these sweeping opinions. Listen to Professor Robert Pape of the University of Chicago, one of America's leading terrorism experts, who, unlike our esteemed opposition tonight, studied every single case of suicide terrorism between 1980 and 2005, 315 cases in total. And he concluded, and I quote, "There is little connection between suicide terrorism and Islamic fundamentalism or any of the world's religions. Rather, what nearly all suicide terrorist attacks have in common is a specific secular and strategic goal to compel modern democracies to withdraw military forces from territory that the terrorists consider to be their homeland." And the irony is, when we talk about terrorism, The irony is that the opposition and the Muslim terrorists, the Al-Qaeda types, actually have one thing in common, because they both believe that Islam is a warlike, violent religion. They both agree on that. They have everything in common. Osama bin Laden would be nodding along to everything he's heard tonight from the opposition side. He agrees with them.
Okay, so after hearing this, I was like, I literally was like, who the hell is this guy? Why do I not know him? And I must, like, find out more. I was a little bit obsessed with you, Mehdi, and I became your total fan at that time. But anyhow, welcome.
I wonder if that's when I was, thank you for having me on the show, Rabia. I wonder if that was the same time that I was listening to Serial with my wife, wondering, who is this Rabia Chowdhury?
I don't think so. I think it was
Rabia,
before
Rabia, that's just him being nice. That's just him being nice.
He's like, who the hell is
when we moved to the US, I swear to God, my wife said, we got to go do like a Serial tour and we got to find Rabia Chowdhury.
He is amazing at what he does. And a very recent venture is that he just launched a new podcast, a hard-hitting podcast called Deconstructed. So anyhow, Mehdi, pleasure to have you on.
Thank you so much for being on. I'm excited to be on your podcast.
Great. So I want to start off actually by talking about Deconstructed. Can you tell us about this new show? Like, what is it? Is it a political show? Is it social commentary? What's the angle?
It's a good question. It's a bit of everything. I mean, it's mainly a political show. It's basically an opportunity for me to do two things that I don't get to do on my TV show that I have with Al Jazeera. One is basically to kind of run my own mouth and air my own views and give my own hot takes of the week, which I'm really not supposed to do when I'm presenting a TV show, even though I kind of sometimes do on that as well. And
nobody nails their guests to the wall like you do, Mehdi.
Yeah, well, thank you. And the second thing I'm trying to do is actually not do, as much as I love nailing people to the wall on my Al Jazeera show, the point of this show is to have a bit more of a conversation. It's a podcast, as you know better than me, Rabia, you're a kind of master of this, been doing it for years, is to have a much more kind of intimate, engaging, friendly conversation about important issues and try and get to the bottom of important issues. So it's a bit of a deep dive. It's a half hour show, but we spend a lot of time on one subject, and especially one subject that I think's been distorted by kind of political and media elites. So, you know, stuff that really annoys me, the coverage of, you know, whether it's Trump's Syria airstrike, or whether it's the coverage of what's going on in Israel, which we're covering on this week's show, whether it's inequality, a subject that gets no coverage at all, really, in the US media, which was our first show that we did with Senator Bernie Sanders.
That's right. So your debut episode featured Bernie Sanders, and that was kind of, you know, amazing to start off with a guest so high profile. Who else do you have lined up?
So we had Hasan Minhaj on last week, who's a great guy. Everyone knows him from The Daily Show. He's going off to do his first Netflix talk show later this year. He and I talked about free speech and kind of agreed and disagreed about, you know, where the lines should be drawn, who can say what, who can stop other people from saying, where are the lines of decency and morality when it comes to being offensive in public. And as a comedian, as a Muslim comedian, his take was, I thought, fascinating. This week, we're going to be talking about Israel and the ongoing violence in Gaza with two of Israel's leading human rights defenders, two heroes of mine, the guys who run B'Tselem and Breaking the Silence.
Fantastic. Well, let's just listen to a clip of this show, and then we'll get back to our conversation.
The Republicans have spent years pushing this line that the media has a liberal bias in this country. And I find liberals seem to be unwilling to push back hard against that narrative. So do you think people on the left should be pushing back much harder against that narrative here
in
Washington, D.C.?
I mean, and the problem is when people talk about somebody being a liberal. And I'm not a liberal. I'm a progressive. What's your view on gay rights? What's your view on racism? What's your view on sexism? Oh, I'm a liberal. But what is your view on whether or not we raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour, whether we rebuild our infrastructure, whether we have progressive taxation? We have got to redefine what is important in America. Today, there are thousands of people in this country who can't afford to go to a doctor. Today, there's a mom waking up who can't afford affordable childcare for her little one. There are senior citizens a mile away from here who are trying to survive on $12,000 a year Social Security.
Should be a huge
scandal. Does anybody
give
a shit about them? Does anyone cover them? The answer is no.
First of all, you've got a TV show, you're a prolific writer, and now podcasting.
I don't sleep, basically.
Yeah, other than the question of how. It's a weekly show, is that right?
It's a weekly show on Fridays, yes.
Okay. Why exactly podcasting? What is it about podcasting that you decided that this is the medium I want to get into?
That is such a good question. And I will be very honest with you, Rabia. Until about a year ago, I'd never listened to a single podcast in my life. I just, not because
God.
I had anything.
So that serial setup was a lie.
Exactly. That's a lie.
Right.
Total lie.
think Cyril in that. I listened to Cyril, but Cyril's like an exception. Cyril's like, right, everyone listened to Cyril. Let's
Rabia,
go.
He just googled Rabia Chaudhry. Oh.
Actually, I'll tell you, I was excited last night when I noticed that Asia McLean had followed me on Twitter. So I am a Cyril.
What?
I did follow Cyril.
Wow.
What's Asia up to? All right, I got that.
But the interesting thing is here that
Cyril is not, you know, that was an exception to us. I think everyone heard even. But in general, like people who listen to podcasts every day, every week, I wasn't one of them. And I have become one over the last year in anticipation of doing a show of my own, but also because I managed to make time for it. That's one of the issues. But, you know, it is a completely different medium in the sense of the intimacy, in the sense of being part of a conversation, in the sense of the time constraints and time limits that you don't necessarily have in other mediums. I do television, I do print. And I think it's such a fascinating way to get across your points and have conversations that you wouldn't have in other places. And also, just separate to my own project, it is very democratizing, just like blogging was, you know, a decade ago. And I think that is very interesting as well. So I'm trying now to up the number of podcasts that I listen to myself. It's a matter of time. But yeah, that's why I really got into it.
Which takes me to my question for Wajahat, where's your podcast?
I have a face for radio. That's what they keep telling me. So I think I might dip into these podcast waters. But I'm like Mehdi, you know, you just have to find the time to navigate the train of all these brilliant podcasts. I get overwhelmed. And my foray into it was, in all sincerity, a Serial and Undisclosed, and your case in particular. And then I'm like, wow. And then just to see your journey of how you were like, what's a podcast? How do I set up the microphone? Oh my God, the first podcast that was terrible audio quality. And then seeing you kind of DIY it yourself to now being like a podcast maven is very inspiring. I think
it is very inspiring, Rabia. You're an inspiration for a lot of people.
Rabia's like, nice. She has like a baby, and then she has like another two kids, and then she has a cat, and then she has like she's drinking chai, and then she's making food for us, and then she's trying to solve
and
like
doing not one case. But two different successful podcasts.
Well,
mashallah, mashallah.
I've had a lot of support.
As we Muslims say, no evil eye. Let's recite some Quran and blow it through the phone to reach Rabia.
You know, you're such an uncle. You're such an uncle, Wajahat. But I got to say this, full disclosure, I have been on Wajahat's case for at least 2 years, at least, saying you need a podcast. Because first of all, people love hearing you. People love hearing, you know, your opinions, your thoughts. You're a fantastic moderator. And right now, actually, I feel a little bit stressed because I am moderating a conversation between two of the best moderators that I know, Wajahat and Mehdi. You guys are both so fantastic in the medium of interviewing.
Can we just warn listeners, if Mehdi invites you to be an interview subject, no and go to another country for like a month.
Not for my podcast, my TV show.
I don't understand. You know, Michael Flynn was interviewed. Like, what's wrong with people?
Three times he came on the show.
I think they're like, oh, I'll take on Mehdi. I'm like, no, just go. Like, if Mehdi invited me, Mehdi's invited me to his house, I've gone. If he invites me on a show, I'm like, F you.
Nope.
Why do you hate me?
I won't do it either. I have so much respect for you. I consider you a friend, Mehdi, but I will never do it. And you know what, Wajahat? I'll tell you the truth. In his head,
I need some guests. I need to pay the bills.
In his head, In his head, though, Mehdi's like, I would never invite you two fools on. So just let's move on from this conversation.
But you know, the funny thing is, Mehdi becomes, he can't help it. Like, you know, when the pit bull just can't help it and like just turns on like he gets
I have no
Wajahat, I have no transferable skills in life apart from the fact that I'm good at arguing with people. That's all I do. I turned it into a job. I made it a hallmark of my marriage. It defined my childhood with my parents.
That's actually very true.
You are meant for this, and I urge our listeners to, first of all, watch that Oxford debate in full, but also you know, check out all these Al Jazeera interviews. Incredible, honestly. I And you know what? We don't have a lot of journalists. It's a real matter of frustration. We don't have a lot of journalists who really will pin their guests to the wall, ask the hard questions, corner them, and not let them pivot and just.
Especially in the U.S. media, sadly, that is undeniably true.
Yeah, it
is. Or even ask follow-up questions. Mehdi asks follow-up questions, and he takes their record and their own quotes and plays it side by side by what they're saying, and asks them to justify it, and you see them wiggle, and you can't. It just saddens you that in America. Yeah, it saddens you in America, especially when we have a president, the 45th, where there's a wealth of ammunition there for journalists to attack him with his own words. You just see, I just see, and you know, Mehdi and I have talked about this a lot. He just gets pass after pass after pass. And if you really want to see Mehdi agitated,
That's how he got elected. I really believe that.
If you really want to see Mehdi agitated, whenever there's like a new interview of Trump on like a major TV show, go to Mehdi's Twitter and he audits the interview in real time, like how he would ask the question.
Not just Trump. Do you remember MBS on 60 Minutes? I ended up writing a rant
at 2 o'clock in the morning because I was so annoyed about that interview with the Saudi crown prince.
Here's a fun fact. Getting your news from social media might not be the best idea. Not only because, well, it's kind of superficial, but also because it might not actually be true. So if you want in-depth coverage, coverage that's based on, well, actual facts, what you need to do is read The Economist. Now, it might sound from its title that it's only about economics, but The Economist is about far more than just finance and economics. It covers a huge range of subjects from politics and business to science, technology, arts, and the environment. And I know the listeners of the 45th are interested in all of these topics. I read The Economist because it's where I can get trustworthy, in-depth, great coverage of stories that matter to me. For example, what's happening in Syria? Now, I've talked about this plenty of times in the podcast, including on today's episode. And just recently, I read an article in The Economist called Where Syria's Despot Bashar Assad is Likely to Strike Next. Now, given the fact that we have recently responded to Bashar Assad's chemical attacks on his population, this is of interest to me. I want to know what his next move is going to be. And The Economist has the kind of expert reporting that can help me understand what's really happening, and whether or not we're actually making a difference over there. Now, that's just one example. Like I said, The Economist has something for everybody, huge range of topics. It is the smart guide to the forces changing your world. And you know what? You can get your free copy today. Get your free copy of The Economist right now. Visit theeconomist.com/45th. All you have to do is enter your details for a free copy delivered direct to your door. Once again, that's economist.com/45th. Let's just get into this. I mean, a lot, like every single week, has happened. But, you know, we always do a little bit of a review about, because we often record on Mondays, how the weekend was for our president. Some weekends are a little bit slow. This one, he was very, very busy. He on Twitter, I mean, not in general.
Is there a weekend when he's not busy on Twitter?
Well, some weekends he's a little quieter. I think he might have broken a record. I think he tweeted like 28 times in a 48-hour period. I mean, it was pretty manic to me. And it was all over, you know, the board, just like it normally is. He kicked off the weekend with tweets about Maggie Haberman and reports that Cohen could flip, and then said, you know, I don't even know her. I've never met her. And then, of course, a photograph emerges of him with her.
And the interviews and the transcripts.
She's probably interviewed him more than any other New York Times journalist, and he claims he never spoke to Maggie Haberman.
You know, I always wonder when this kind of stuff happens, because it happens constantly, is he in like a cognitive decline, or is he just lying out of his teeth?
It's the biggest question of all. It's such an important question.
Yeah, it is an important question.
I think you guys give him a pass when you say that he's in cognitive decline. This is who Trump is. This is how he's always been. And I think we forget that President Obama really diagnosed him well, according allegedly to quotes. He's a professional bullshit artist. He has lied through his teeth, through everything, because he's gotten away with it. He's a habitual liar, and we all know liars. Once they get used to it, they can't even help it. It's almost like unintentional, like reflex gag move. You just lie.
But these are so easily verifiable, these lies.
No, I think you've got to separate out the type of lies he tells.
There's the lies he tells just to throw something against the wall and see what sticks, see what he can get away with. There's the bullshit artist component that Wajahat mentioned. That's part of his lifelong career. I do think there are a separate type of lies which are related to some screw missing in his head, some form of, you know, cognitive. If you look at the older interviews he did in the 80s and 90s, he wasn't saying as mad stuff as he says now. And you know, one example I'd give you is and he was lying then too about his wealth, about his conquests, about et cetera, et cetera. I'll give you one example. When he went to, you know, there's this argument, is this all a great media strategy when he does these tweets to distract journalists, throw them off, change the subject? Is he playing 4D chess? Or is this actually, you know, a crazy guy who can't control his mouth? And I'll be honest with you, it depends on the day of the week, and I will give you a different answer. Sometimes I genuinely can't tell. Is he mad or is he brilliant? And I'll give you an example. When he went to Puerto Rico after the hurricane, and he was speaking, and he's speaking to, you know, journalists and local officials, etc., and he started talking about the F-22 or some fighter jet. and how much he's paid for them and how much, you know, how much America's made money off the literally nothing to do with the conversation. Now, I don't believe that was 3D or 4D chess. I believe that's just a crazy old man. You know, we all know the uncles or granduncles we have in our families who will turn up for dinner and just say mad stuff and ramble away. And we all kind of smile and look away. So I do think there's an element of the madman and there is an element of the kind of the guy who wrote The Art of the Deal and said, this is how you trick journalists. And I don't, you know, it's hard to separate out the two these days.
Bono, well, maybe it's all the above. I mean,
I don't think he knows even how to play 2D chess or 3D chess. I think we have to give him credit where credit's due, is that he's a master media manipulator because that's his bread and butter. That's what's made him. Yeah, and he's good at it. He knows reality
TV. It's the only thing he's good at.
He knows what makes headlines. He knows what's salacious. He knows what sells. He knows how to attract journalists to wag their tail to his barks. But at the same time, what we're witnessing, and it goes back to your point, Robbie, with these tweets, in the past year and a year and a half, he has never been under this much global scrutiny like he has been before. He's not allowed to be his charming Donald Trump self. He now has to basically be the representative of more than 300 million people as the commander in chief. And that type of scrutiny, especially when it comes to his ego, his finances, his taxes, his relationships, is making him not mad, but slightly unhinged. And he's reacting, react, react. And this is a guy, let's not forget, who believes that anytime they attack you, who takes the Roger Stone model, you fight back. You deny and you fight back. And even so over the weekend,
even if it's the widow of a dead soldier.
Yeah, doesn't matter. And so over the weekend, we had two gems that I have to bring up, unless we forget. Wendy Wasserman Schultz. Let's find this missing Wendy Wasserman Schultz, America. Let's find who this doppelganger of Debbie Wasserman Schultz is. And number two, this is day five of the mysterious Pakistani businessman. I'm on the case. Me and Rabia have been trying to locate.
Is it you? I think it might be you.
There's,
is it Hasan Minhaj? Who is it?
It's 10 people.
Hasan Minhaj is Indian, like me.
Yeah. Oh, darn. Okay.
It's 10 people, and 7 of them happen to be related to me and Rabia. So by the end of the week, we'll find out the mysterious Pakistani
business. Come on, Nantiani.
I mean, the name calling, he's now, you know, the sleepy Chuck, sleepy eyes Chuck
Todd, the slimy Jim Comey. That doesn't stop at all, and no one has control over his Twitter account when it comes to that stuff.
Ironically, he also tweeted that, you know, there are reports that I have, you know, I called Jeff Sessions Mr. Magoo, and basically he's like, I wouldn't do that.
I wouldn't do that. It's too
that's
soft.
That's like months ago.
Don't forget,
the First Lady carries on with her online bullying campaign, anti-bullying campaign.
Well, the First Lady stays as far away as possible from him. Speaking of First Ladies, I do want to move on to, you know, some big news, which is the passing away of a First Lady.
That was a neat segue.
I do what I can to move it along.
But very elegant, Rabia.
Donald Trump, you know, did a short and sweet little tweet of her picture and then went on to golf on the day of her funeral. But Barbara Bush passed away on April 17th at the age of 92. And, you know, the reaction over the weekend from her funeral, from her death, has been really interesting for me to watch. Generally speaking, I've always felt like she was kind of like, she was just not somebody that occupied a lot of space, like, in my head. And I didn't think of her in really, like, terms of, like, controversy or politics. Or, you know, she was known for her literacy programs, married to her husband for 73 years, by all accounts, a very loving, devoted marriage. You know, her husband's now 90, almost 94, I think. But it was interesting for me to watch, like, the reaction online. And a lot of prominent figures were actually like, I'm not going to honor this. We should not be honoring this woman. She was a racist and she raised monsters. And I don't know. I'm a little conflicted about all that. Did you guys follow this? And what are your thoughts about what's going on here?
Yeah. Maybe you want to go first? I have thoughts.
I mean, I followed the academic who was kind of pilloried for saying this. What was more interesting for me?
Rhonda Girard.
Can you give the background about that too, by the way?
Yeah, so Rhonda Girard is a novelist, very talented. She's a tenured teacher, I think, in Fresno, and Arab American. And she went to town on Twitter and said, I'm so glad that the old witch is dead. I can't wait for the other Bush members to follow her. I remember her for being a racist. This is the same woman who couldn't care less about the 150,000, no, 1.5 million Iraqi lives that were destroyed from the reckless first Iraq war and the second one. And also, let's not forget about what she said about the survivors of Katrina, specifically the poor black men and women who were taken to stadiums. And Barbara Bush said, well, they're probably get better treatment than they've ever had before in their lives. So she was like, she's a racist and I'm glad she's dead and you can't touch me because I'm tenured. And of course, then now there's a huge campaign against
her. That's the more interesting part of the story, to move it away from Barbara Bush for a second, which is, for years, all we've heard about, and actually I devoted the Deconstructed podcast last week with Hasan Minhaj to this subject of campus free speech and the weaponization of free speech by the right. We've heard from conservatives for years that, oh, look at these left-wing crazies, totalitarians. They want to shut down free speech. They don't want anyone to say things offensively on campus. They don't want colleges to be free speech areas, et cetera, et cetera. They're all snowflakes. And yet, we see how opportunistic they are when it comes to things that they don't like the sound of. They're very happy to go after professors and students and try and destroy people's lives and careers. They're complete hypocrites.
But I think we have to be fair also, because I'm totally name dropping, but yesterday we're at that Pan America Voices Festival and Hillary Clinton gave the keynote, and she said in 91, Barbara Bush, you know, she was being boycotted also for the war, but Wellesley, the female college, invited her. In that speech, she talked about, you know, on your deathbed, it's not the jobs, it's not the degrees, it's not the awards, even though that's important. What you really is going to be beside you are the relationships that you've created in life, you know, your husband, your kids. And that got a standing ovation. And so many people see her as this, you know, this, she herself knew her image, old, curly white hair, pearls, harmless.
But homemaker.
The reality was, homemaker. But the reality was, for all those who have followed the Bush dynasty, is that
married to a war criminal, mother of a war criminal.
But she's the steel spine, the acerbic steel spine of that family. Mm. And you see the juxtaposition of, oh, okay, she was against segregation, she was pro-choice, yes, she was a nice
anti-Trump
mother, but also she made these racist comments against the Iraqis.
I want to be fair about that. It is true what she said about the folks after touring post-Katrina, the Astrodome. What she said was, this is the exact quote. She said, what I'm hearing, which is sort of scary, is they all want to stay in Texas. Everyone is so overwhelmed by the hospitality. And so many people in the area here, you know, were underprivileged anyway. So this is working very well for them. Now, you can construct that however you want. There are people who say that this was her understanding of like the kind of responses people were giving to her, but I might be a little concerned about her remark. Now, on the Iraqi stuff, to be fair, the quote that she gave was in the context before the war. And what she was being asked
about, not bothering my beautiful mind, that one.
Right. First, let me set up like what she was asked. It was before the war. The war was being considered. And she was asked whether her and the president, you know, for her husband, were watching the news and following, like, you know, the conversations and, you know, the debates about whether we should go to war, what it would mean and all that. And in response to that, she said, but why should we hear about body bags and deaths and how many, what date's going to happen and how many this or what do you suppose? Or, I mean, it's not relevant. So why should I waste my beautiful mind on something like that and watch him suffer,
so
her
bad
husband? It sounds bad,
so bad,
but the context, this is, to be fair, the context was this. What she was saying really was that I don't want to hear people talk for 24 hours a day about what could happen in the war, because that's, none of it's happened. And she's like, for me, 90% of news is supposition. It's not really news. It's just people arguing, and I'm not wasting my time on that. So she wasn't talking about actual deaths. This is not after the war. This is before the war. And I think that makes a difference.
But Robbie, at the end of the day, and you know, I've seen those quotes and I used to get annoyed about them, and I've seen the Snopes piece debunk it. At the end of the day, she wasn't a public figure in the sense of being an elected figure herself. She was only a public figure through being the wife of a president and the mother of a president and the mother of a guy who wanted to be president but got his ass handed to him by Donald Trump. She is now dead. And as much as I kind of loathe the Bush family, my view is I'm happy to kick, you know, prominent, you know, I've written pieces about prominent people who have died attacking them, and people say, oh, you shouldn't speak ill of the dead. No, if you're a political figure and you die, I have every right to go through your record and point that out. And with her, my view has been, I haven't really tweeted about her, I haven't really written anything about her. My view is, I wasn't a fan of her or her family, but on the other hand, she just died, and clearly she, you know, people loved her and she had human relationships. What, you know, why go after her? Of all the things to go after right now, I wouldn't go after Barbara Bush. What I would say is the rehabilitation of the Bush family by some sections of the media and some Democrats because of Trump is a problem for me. And look, I say that as someone who wrote a New York Times article in December 2015 in which I said, I miss George W. Bush was a headline. And I got attacked by lots of people on the left, lots of people in the Muslim community saying, how can you just give him a pass? He killed all these people in Iraq. And I said, look, I'm not denying his crimes. All I'm saying is, compared to the current crop of GOP candidates from Rubio
to Trump, to all of the rest of the people at that time, who were all card-carrying Islamophobes. At least George W. Bush was not an open Islamophobe in the same way. He wasn't this deranged, openly racist candidate in the way that George W. Bush, in the way that Donald Trump was at that time. Now, having written that piece, I still stand by that piece in the context of that time, but I do have to take a step back and say, we've gone too far now in the kind of, let's forgive Bush all his crimes. People have just forgotten that it wasn't just Iraq. The entire Bush presidency was a racket. It was authoritarian. It was a criminal enterprise. It was corrupt. Don't people forget Enron? The whole thing was a disaster, and I worry that we're just kind of... He paints now, and he hugs Ellen, and, you know, he says nice things about freedom of speech and the freedom of the media, and he rejected Trump, and his mother rejected Trump, and his father rejected Trump. And that's my bigger worry, the rehabilitation of the Bushes in particular, but of all previous presidents, and giving all previous presidents a pass simply because the current president is undoubtedly so bad and sui generis.
Can I say one final thing about the Bush dynasty and why I think sometimes we give them a pass? Barbara Bush, again, was the steel spine of that family, heavily involved in the kids' lives, very influential. She wasn't like completely removed like wallpaper, like Melania, who is still running, as Mehdi said, her anti-online bullying campaign by doing nothing, lateral thinking. That's an interesting strategy. But let's never forget that George Bush, the senior, ran one of the most racist ads, the Willie Horton ad campaign.
Yeah, Bush senior gets a pass too. You're right. You're right.
That derailed Dukakis. And specifically, that was a setup of, look, they released this black man, and when he was on furlough, what did he do? He raped and killed, and that's what's going to happen if Dukakis...
He was also a war criminal like his son. People forget Gulf War I. They bombed air raid shelters full of civilians. They buried Iraqi conscripts alive. I mean, Bush Sr. gets a pass on all of that.
And Katrina, right? And Katrina, and Sears, and the Patriot Act. So
that's Bush Jr. I'm talking about Bush Sr.
Oh, yeah, but Bush Sr. and then Bush Jr. But going back to those original quotes, Ravi, and putting them in context, I think we could clearly see is a fundamental remove from the plights and struggles of many minority Americans, specifically people of color, a fundamental distance that did not cloud her consciousness or her conscientiousness because it was too disturbing for her beautiful mind. And so if we have to air the dirty laundry with the nice white pearls, I haven't gone after her. There are bigger fish to fry. But at the same time, these dynasties have helped perpetuate and create the Frankenstein that eventually became the Trump administration. Everything is connected.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And what the region has been experiencing for decades now. Absolutely. When I say the region, I mean like the Middle East and further on.
Just on Bush, just one very brief thing. Bush Sr., because he probably is going to pass away soon too. He's not in the best of health. People are going to say, oh, don't knock the man. He just died. So let me slag him now while he's still alive. He had a series of accusations from Me Too campaigners recently about him groping people from his wheelchair. Not to mention the war crimes I already mentioned and the Willie Horton ad that Wajahat mentioned and the whole Reagan presidency of which he was vice president. So, you know, this is not a nice guy either. Let's not pretend that these people are some kind of nice guys simply because they're not Trump.
So moving on, and speaking of fish to fry, one of the fish we all want to see fry, Donald Trump, you know, I'm seeing a lot more online now that, you know what, this guy's just not going to go to prison. We may as well just forget about that. He might step aside on his own. Maybe he won't run in 2020. But a new development in the last week might hold him accountable in another way, and that is a lawsuit filed by the DNC. I was really kind of surprised and shocked that this happened. Given that the Mueller investigation is ongoing, given that it seems like to me a bit of a distraction, maybe premature. I don't know. Have you guys read the lawsuit? Have you been following the story?
Ravi, are you a fan of this lawsuit? You think it's going to have value?
This is what I'm not sure about. This, you know, I will say this. It will force it. It could, if it's not dismissed, it could force like things opening up in court. You know, through depositions, through discovery.
But it's a civil suit, and it's against the Russian government. You think the Russian government are going to be brought to a U.S. civil court against the Trump campaign, which makes them look like bad losers, and against WikiLeaks, which some would argue is pretty outrageous to go after an organization for publishing documents. That's a threat to press freedom, many would argue.
Well, let me read the list of defendants, by the way. It's pretty impressive. So it starts off with the Russian Federation, and the plaintiff is the DNC. Defendants are the Russian Federation, the General Staff of the Armed Forces of the Russian Federation, GRU, also, which is known as Guccifer or Guccifer, whatever is 2.0, this guy who is very involved.
Yeah, none of whom are ever going to turn up in court.
Never going to turn up, right. Aglarov, we've talked about him, two different Aglarovs, Amin Aglarov and Aras Aglarov. Joseph Mifsud, yeah. We've talked about him on the show before. WikiLeaks, Julian Assange. Donald J. Trump for president, meaning the campaign. Donald J. Trump Jr., meaning the son. Paul Manafort, Roger Stone, Jared Kushner, George Papadopoulos, Richard Gates, and John Doe's 1 through 10.
Can I just pick up on the WikiLeaks one on there? Because that's the one I feel strongly about. Look, I am not a fan of Julian Assange. And I think WikiLeaks, at the beginning, I was a big supporter of WikiLeaks. In recent years, I've taken a slightly different stance on WikiLeaks, seeing what they've done since. But look at what their allegation in the suit. The suit says, I believe in paragraph 183, that WikiLeaks is liable for damages when it willfully and intentionally disclosed the DNC's communications, the stolen emails, the Podesta stuff, etc. And I find that pretty outrageous for the DNC to go after WikiLeaks on those grounds, because why wouldn't you then go after the New York Times, the Guardian, the Washington Post, all the media organizations who then published those newsworthy emails? They may be stolen, but they were clearly newsworthy emails. Otherwise, hundreds of media organizations wouldn't have covered the contents of those emails. And media organizations have published stolen or leaked emails and documents for years. Going back to Watergate, going back to Daniel Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers. So I don't buy this argument that you can go after WikiLeaks. As much as you may dislike WikiLeaks and Julian Assange and think they played an awful role in helping Trump getting elected, I think it's outrageous for the Democrats or the DNC, the Democratic National Committee, to say they're liable for damages for disclosing stolen documents. Because where do you draw the line then? That is a threat to media freedom by any definition.
I think the lawsuit is a masturbatory performative exercise for parts of their base to make themselves look relevant. I think it's ultimately toothless for the reasons that are mentioned, and also strategically, I think, unwise, because the DNC does not have a good reputation, especially when it comes to folks on the left. The Sanders folks are still pissed off because of Wendy Wasserman Schultz. We know that Russia has tried to influence more divides within the DNC and Democrats and liberals with Jill Stein and Sanders and Clinton in the email dumps, Tom Perez and Ellison. They're trying their hardest. Those are the chair and the deputy chair, but they're lagging behind by millions when it comes to fundraising compared to the RNC.
I'd be interested to know if Keith Ellison really supports this lawsuit. I'd love to know privately what they were discussing, because
activate the Muslim bat signal.
My impression is that Keith Ellison is, as the deputy chair, is probably more interested in fixing the Democrats' problems with their base, with working class communities, with people across the board who they lost touch with in recent years, and is less interested in this kind of performative exercise, which Tom Perez has come up with, which is much more about media attention and going Russia, 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 Russia. And I'm not one of these people who denies the Russian role in the last election. Clearly, Russia tried to interfere in the election. Clearly, Donald Trump has some kind of dodgy relationship with Russia. I don't know what it is. I'm not one of these people in denial about that. But on the other hand, I do find it astonishing that the Democrats are focusing on that, not on all the other aspects of the campaign that they screwed up on royally from start to finish.
Look, the lawsuit raises 13 different causes of action, 13 different counts, including computer fraud, RICO, conspiracy, violations of the Wiretap Act, meaning hacking. And so I think while I agree with you that on the principle that you raised, Mehdi, in terms of like, you know, why WikiLeaks and why not all these other organizations, if they have committed a crime through, like, you know, hacking.
There's zero evidence of that.
Right. I mean, well, that's the thing. So, you know, you're making the arguments the defense counsel can make and maybe get them dismissed as a defendant. I mean, it doesn't mean just because all these defendants are listed.
But put aside the law. But Rabia, put aside the law for a moment. We live in very tribal times, right? So everyone, the problem we have in American politics right now is if the other side does something bad, we jump up and down. If our side does it, we don't jump up and down. And that applies to Republicans as much as Democrats. So let me give you an example. Last March, Rachel Maddow on her show had Trump's 2005 tax return. Were you not interested in that? Did we not all? I was celebrate. I was like, great, we get to see something at least. It didn't turn out to be the smoking gun we wanted, but everyone was very excited when she announced, I'm going to show some of his tax return. It is illegal to disclose someone's tax returns without the taxpayer's permission.
Okay. Well. Okay. So maybe then she was willing to make herself, liable to a lawsuit. But I will say this. I mean, the difference between what Rachel Maddow did and what WikiLeaks might have done, and I don't know. Again, we have no idea whether any of these allegations hold water. Is that she was supplied a document through a source versus her herself being complicit in going and hacking.
And as much as we dislike Julian Assange, there's zero evidence.
There might be. And I actually think, they might be dismissed as a plaintiff. If they find, I'm sure they're going to file a motion to dismiss, vis-a-vis their standing in the lawsuit. I don't think at the end of the day, all the defendants are going to, stand in this lawsuit. I don't think the whole...
Russian intelligence are going to turn up at a court in New York.
I also don't think the lawsuit is completely toothless. I'll be honest. I do think that this lawsuit is going to force some of the actors here, like the Manafort, Trump Jr., maybe the campaign, it's going to force litigation on them, and it's going to maybe force them to give over in discovery documents that otherwise,
But you know what? I hope you're right, because, and like everyone else, who knows? But I'm having researched this.
I'm not saying it's a good idea, but no,
But the reason why I still think they shouldn't have done it yet is because the one individual that has a remarkably high rating from most Americans, regardless of politics, right now is Robert Mueller in the Mueller investigation. It's about 70%.
Hold on. Did you say regardless of politics? That's not true at all. Republicans hate Mueller now. If you look at the polling now, Trump has succeeded, as he succeeded on every other front, in turning the Republican base against Mueller. Have a look at the late—I can't remember the number off the top of my head—but over the weekend, I just saw they've switched on Mueller.
But most Americans, it's at 70, right?
I didn't say most of it. I said you said regardless of politics. I'm saying that's not true. Republicans, being the cult that they are these days, have followed their commander in chief and now believe that Mueller is leading a deep state conspiracy against their president.
Fair enough. I'll retract it and say most Americans actually have faith in Mueller, want him protected, and want this investigation to end. So I think when you have a mostly credible, respected individual, according to the toxic politics of the day, yes, who is following these leads, this comes in kind of from the side, as I think, again.
I don't understand the strategy. I don't understand the timing. That is for sure.
Let Mueller finish it. And Mueller, okay, as we've seen so far, and you're an attorney, I'm a recovering attorney, he is going deep. The people he's brought onto his team, they're following the money. And I believe that the way you really get Trump is by doing the nitty-gritty hard work that no one wants to do, not the PP tape, not the golden showers, not, he said, she said, but it's following the money trail and the potential money launderings, allegedly with Russian oligarchs when it deals with his properties. That's what's going to get him. And the cover-ups and Michael Cohen and the hush money and their incompetence and their own lies.
Always the cover-ups.
Huh?
It's always the cover.
Stormy Daniels.
I have a theory about why they might have filed this, and that actually relates to, if you look at the prayer for relief. The prayer for relief is what the plaintiff is asking the court. Like, what do they want at the end of the day? What are they asking the court to do? In this case, they're asking for a whole slew of damages, all kinds of damages, punitive damages, treble damages, meaning money. But another thing they're also asking is this. They're asking for injunctive relief, restraining the defendants and their officers, agents, servants, all that stuff, from accessing the plaintiff's computers in the future, accessing the personal emails. I think they might be thinking this is a way to protect us from all of this shit happening again as the 2018 elections approach. That is my only theory in terms of timing on this. What do you guys think? Maybe?
No, it's good. That might be a good. So what I'll say is you could be correct about that as well. And then it hinges on the following. Will it eventually help or hurt them, especially in light of everything that we've discussed? And was it necessary to do this in this way right now while there's an ongoing investigation? That's my take. And maybe it's for the injunctive relief that you've mentioned, just another layer of protection, knowing full well, according to our intelligence agencies, that Russia...
Nobody's stopping anything. Nobody's doing anything about it, right?
Nobody's doing anything. Literally no one's doing anything. It's like begging the president to take leadership, and the fact that he hasn't, that should be a crisis in a normal presidency. But that is just one of mashallah...
This is not a normal presidency.
Yeah, this is one of a 19 crisis.
Your daily reminder that this is not a normal presidency.
And also, also maybe to help their base, right? Maybe saying, listen, we take this seriously, guys, and we're doing something about it, and this is what we're doing. And so for their fundraisers and their donors who demand some sort of proactive strategic action, maybe Perez and others are saying, okay, this is what we've come up with right now.
I want to do a few minutes on North Korea developments recently, and then we're going to do Syria. All right. So North Korea, it seems like our president has a blossoming friendship with Kim Jong-un. Now, this is what happened on March 8th. Trump announced his willingness and interest to meet the leader of North Korea. And honestly, I was also one of those people who kind of scoffed and said, people were like, where are they going to meet? How are they going to do it? Well, he sent Pompeo to do it. CIA Director Mike Pompeo actually went, I think, met with him three times. And since then, this is what's happened. Kim Jong-un has let it be known that he's willing to discuss denuclearization and a peace treaty to end the Korean War without insisting on a pullout of U.S. forces. Like I said, Pompeo went to Pyongyang to meet with him. And just this past Friday, Kim announced that he will end nuclear and missile tests and shut down a particular site where those tests have been conducted. Now, in response to this, Trump has been tweeting all these great things. Look what I've done. We're friends. We have a good relationship now. And a Washington Post article that I read recently said that, you know, Trump is being completely conned. So the question is he being conned or is this actually a win for the president?
It's a very good question. But I mean, to be honest, I wouldn't look at it through the prism of whether it's a win for the president or not. There's a bigger issue, which is the North Korean nuclear crisis is probably the biggest security crisis in the world. You know, we talk endlessly about Syria and Iran and Iraq and ISIS and all these other places. But fundamentally, the highest likelihood of us all dying is in a nuclear war between the US and North Korea, which we were very close to at the start of this year. Remember, New Year's Day, or President Trump was, or 2nd of Jan, was it 1st or 2nd of Jan? The start of this year was Trump tweeting about his button being bigger than Kim's button and warning of fire and fury and all of that nonsense about, you know, he was literally threatening a nuclear war at that stage a few months
ago. And now he's got John Bolton on his right hand.
Now he's got John Bolton, who, you know, who's
the pacifist, the moderate pacifist.
John Bolton, who's never met a country he didn't want to invade, bomb, occupy. And therefore, you know, you see this switch in Trump from going from fire and fury, bigger button, to I'm willing to meet with him. And that, you know, take Trump out of the equation. For me, that's a good thing. I think there should be more diplomacy, more negotiations, face-to-face talks. And people forget, to bring it back to Trump, of course, Obama, when he was running for president, said he would meet with the leaders of Cuba, Iran, North Korea. And who slammed him? The Republican slammed him. The right slammed him. Isn't it funny that if a Democrat president had proposed what Trump is proposing, had Hillary Clinton sent her CIA director to meet secretly with Kim, can you imagine the headlines on Fox? Instead, as I mentioned earlier, we live in this tribal climate now, so it doesn't matter as long as your side do it. You have Fox News headlines saying what a great peacemaker Trump is. He's doing what the Democrats couldn't do. In terms of the issues themselves, is he getting conned? Is America getting conned? We don't know. The North Koreans have a habit of lying and breaking agreements. By the way, so do the Americans. So we don't know at this stage. But what we do know is that there's a lot more still to be done. And Trump on Sunday tweeted, quote, "Wow, we haven't given up anything and they have agreed to denuclearization. So great for the world. Site closure and no more testing." Yeah, they haven't. Notice the big whopper of a lie in that statement. The North Koreans have not. They've agreed to shut down one site and do no more tests. And most experts say, you know why they've said that? Because they don't need to do any more tests. Their weapons are good enough to go and they're fine with the weapons they have. And explicitly, Kim is saying that we will not give up our weapons. We'll stop testing. Basically, North Korea wants respect. North Korea wants to be treated as a nuclear weapon state, like the Permanent Five, like Israel, like India and Pakistan. I think there are 8 declared nuclear weapon states in the world. North Korea wants to be the 9th and be treated respectfully as the 9th, and that's what he's going into negotiations for. Now, will Trump be able to handle such a negotiation? Clearly not. I don't think we need to ask that. That's my bigger worry. You have this summit, they turn up in Ulaanbaatar or wherever they plan to have it. Do you trust Donald Trump in a summit on such a sensitive and complicated issue as nuclear diplomacy? The man can't negotiate, you know, he's with his own private lawyer. The idea that he could negotiate with a foreign leader on such a big subject is absurd.
There's his ability to actually negotiate something so sensitive and complex, and which to me is mostly about, does he even understand what the hell's going on? I mean, that particular tweet that you just read completely
mischaracterizes. Remember, he didn't know what the nuclear triad was.
Yeah, nuclear triad, he has no idea. I'll just say 3 things real quick, as I'm a fan of diplomacy, and so the diplomatic means is perhaps the only means in what is potentially the most catastrophic event that could occur in our lifetimes, as Mehdi mentioned. And President Obama warned Donald Trump that this would be one of the biggest national security threats that the world is facing right now. Number two, I do believe he's being played by Kim Jong-un and others, because Kim Jong-un and others want legitimacy and normalization. And more that Donald Trump speaks like this, without really having an understanding and grasp of what he's doing or a strategy, it further legitimizes North Korea, as Mehdi was mentioning, as a world player. Number three, finally, North Korea will never denuclearize. Why? The second that it does that, it is its own death sentence. That is the only deterrent it has to stay in power with this brutal dictatorship.
They saw what happened to Colonel Gaddafi when he gave up his WMD program.
They will never do it, ever. And so the fact that Trump tweeted that goes back to our point that I don't think he has an understanding or grasp of what's happening.
He just wants to do a deal, he loves doing deals.
He wants to win.
He wants a handshake, he wants a photo, he wants a win, and he wants praise.
That's what Rabia said. He just wants the win for his base. He's not going to get this win.
And you know, to that point, I just want to end by saying this in this discussion. Just 2 days ago, a presenter on North Korea's media, their media television, read out a resolution issued by the government, said, this is the title of the resolution, on proclaiming great victory of the line of simultaneously development of economic construction and building of nuclear force. And if you read, that's the actual title. And if you read the resolution, it's going to make it very clear that they have absolutely no interest in completely denuclearizing.
In fact, Kim says in the statement he made announcing the shutting down of the testing and the site, he specifically said, we promise not to give our nukes to anyone else, which basically means we're keeping our nukes. We're just not going to give them to anyone else.
Right. And it's about that one site. All right. You mentioned earlier a couple of the other threats that seem to occupy a lot more time and space in the media, ISIS, the Middle East, and Syria in particular. You know, the proxy wars that are happening in Syria now between Russia, Iran. I mean, like, we've been, you know, we've recently had some strikes. And you caused a bit of a stir last week publishing. It was in The Intercept, correct?
Yes.
This recent piece about the war in Syria. And basically, you made the argument that, you know, whether or not Bashar Assad gassed anybody, he is still a war criminal. Now, one of the things I've been noticing online is, and I'll be honest, just in the last episode we did, I confessed that this is a conflict that is very, very difficult to take a stance on. I think it's very hard to be consistent on this. Mm. It's very hard to be principled on this. It's hard to know how you think this is going to end. At the end of the day, I mean, at the end of that podcast, I was like, you know what? I can't believe I'm saying this, because a few years ago, I wouldn't have been saying this. But now I feel like the only resolution here would have to be, we are not going to get rid of Bashar Assad. It's not going to happen. You know, the rebels are going to continue to be killed. So are the civilians. Would be some kind of negotiated peace, allowing him to stay, maybe sharing power, but probably not. But having said that, you know, you kind of look at the conflict from all sides. Can you explain to me a little bit about, can you explain to me like where you stand on this conflict? I've read some of your pieces, including a piece from a year ago that you wrote of the Syrian people have been betrayed by all sides. And you explore like the complicated, you know, factors in this conflict and how it's hard to really be principled on it.
It is very hard to be consistent, to be principled, to not be tribal, to not be sectarian, to not be partisan. And it's a real problem. This is, you know, it's one of the worst conflicts of the modern era, one of the biggest humanitarian crises in the world. The death toll is horrific. The number of refugees is, you know, globally consequential. And unfortunately, I remember, basically, I interviewed Lakhdar Brahimi, the former Algerian foreign minister who became a UN envoy on Syria and left, like previous UN envoys, disgruntled, demoralized, disillusioned. And he said to me, look, there are no good guys in Syria. And this is the problem. There's, you know, we see foreign conflicts and wars through this kind of binary, simplistic prism of black, white, good, evil, right, wrong. And unfortunately in Syria, maybe there was a time when there were good guys on one side and bad guys on the other. But right now, 7 years into this horrific conflict, we can place blame in different places for it. But really, it's very hard to find any good guys. You have Bashar al-Assad, who is, in my view and in the view of many analysts of this conflict, many human rights groups, responsible for the majority of civilian deaths, responsible for the vast bulk of the violence, is the root cause of the conflict in the sense that he is a dictator who refused to step aside during the Arab Spring in 2011. And on the other side, sadly, you have, and I use the phrase of he's a monster and he's up against a bunch of mini monsters. You have Syrian rebel groups, both quote unquote Islamist and secular, who have carried out some of the worst crimes of all, from murder to kidnapping to torture to we see horrific crimes across the board. And therefore, it's very hard to come and say, well, are you pro-Assad? Are you anti-Assad? Are you pro-rebel? Are you anti-rebel? I hate all these titles. And what I hate most, and why I wrote the piece last week, is so many people on my side of the spectrum, whether they're Muslims, whether they're on the left, who out of some misguided anti-imperialism or anti-Israeli or anti-American stance are willing to either turn a blind eye to Assad's crimes or even deny those crimes. And that's why I wrote this piece saying, look, you know, we can argue whether he carried out this chemical weapons strike, which, you know, there's still no hard evidence in that it was him. But what we can't argue about is that he drops barrel bombs on his people, that he's killed peaceful protesters, that he sent suicide bombers into Iraq in 2005, 6, 7, where was the great secular leader then, that he has tortured thousands of people in his prisons, that refugees in Germany, when they were interviewed, said, we're running from him, number one, and ISIS, number two. So and we yet, have to acknowledge
and yet,
who this person is.
The best option might still be a negotiation.
Well, I wouldn't use best option, but yeah, I mean, least worst option, less. I say in the piece, maybe Assad is the lesser of two evils, but that still makes him an evil. And I don't have a solution for Syria. I think anyone who says they have a solution for Syria is either a liar or a fool. I don't think there is a solution in Syria. But all I can say is, I can say what's wrong. And I think we have to be principled. To go back to something I said earlier in the show, we can't play this game where I will only condemn, you know, we have all these people who support Assad and they obsess over crimes by the rebels. And you have people who oppose Assad and turn a blind eye to the rebels' crimes. And I'm saying, call out human rights abuses across the board in this horrible conflict. Yes, you could say one side is more responsible than the other. Fine. But don't deny human rights abuses simply because your team or your gang or your government or your country is the one doing them.
We have to be morally consistent.
Exactly.
And the lack of moral consistency where people are willing to voluntarily subvert their humanity, their morals or principles just to support, as Mehdi said, their team is perhaps one of the most painful and distressing things to witness, especially on social media, where Mehdi, by virtue of simply, and I agree with Mehdi's piece, and if I may say so, he sent me a draft of this piece before he published it, and I'm like, you're going to get destroyed, but I'm glad you're writing it. One thing in addition that I'll say is the following, that we should not forget that this war in Syria has gone on for 7 years. 500,000 people have been killed. 11 million people have been displaced. The one thing that we can do in what seems like an utterly insurmountable, perplexing crisis of the modern era is at least open our doors and our homes and our hearts as Americans, because we used to be a country that used to invite refugees to start a new life and have a chance at the American dream. We have sent less than 200 missiles to attack Syria, where nothing happened. It was just a dent. But we have only allowed 11 Syrian refugees to come to the United States in this past year alone.
Which shows that Trump doesn't give a damn about Syrians. This idea that he intervened because he saw Syrian children suffering from gas is complete BS.
So I want Ivanka to take an onion to her eyeball and cry for Syrian refugees and Yemeni refugees and DACA recipients, and then show her dad. And the least that we can do, especially here at home, is perhaps lobby for this administration and our government to allow more Syrian refugees to come here and make America great again.
Well, thanks so much. But, you know, actually, I wanted to be able to talk about some immigration and immigrant right issues that have developed in the last week. Things are just getting hairier and scarier, even for people who are actually here. We just haven't had time, but I'd love to have you both back on to talk about that at some point.
As an immigrant, I'm very scared. As an immigrant, I'm very scared. I'm a Muslim immigrant in Donald Trump's America. I'm madness. What a time to move.
But at least you're Indian. Me and Robbie are Pakistani Muslim American son of immigrants. And like nobody likes us, man. Like it's gotten so bad, I tell people I'm pre-partition Indian, who's spiritual. That's like
it's
my line.
It's not going to save you. Well, Jahidin won't save you. But anyway, I want to thank both of you for coming on this week. And I know, Mehdi, you have to run. I would have loved to discuss further. And I would love, love, love to have you back as well. But before we head out, Wajahat, can you tell our listeners where they can find you online and how they can reach you?
At Wajahat Ali on the Twitters. I'm also on Facebook, and I'll try my best to respond.
All right. And Mehdi, can you tell us how folks can reach you on social media and also how they can subscribe to Deconstructed?
Yes, I'm on Twitter. I spend too much time on Twitter. I'm at Mehdi R. Hassan. And you can subscribe to Deconstructed at theintercept.com/deconstructed.
All right, guys. Thank you guys so much. Have a great week. And listeners, we'll be back in 7 days. Thanks so much.
big thanks to all our listeners for tuning in to the 45th podcast week after week. And if you'd like to give us further support, you can do that by becoming a patron at patreon.com/45thpod. By doing so, you can become a supporter and patron for as little as $5 a month. And to do so, again, go to patreon.com/45thpod. A shout out and thank you to our sponsors. They make this program possible. And I urge our listeners to please check out our sponsors and use their products. And thank you to them for helping us produce week after week. Thank you to our audio producer, Hannah McCarthy, our executive producer, Meethal Thelhan. We have been produced by Long Arc Digital Media, and you can find us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. Our handle is at 45th Pod. Our website is www.45thpod.com. And guess what? You can even leave us a voice message. Call us at 202-670-8345. And you never know, we might just play your message on the air. Thanks again for tuning in. See you next week.
Sarah was about to bring up the babies from downstairs. I'm like, my babies are coming. Can you bless them with Chimamanda magic and just blow on them? And then she goes, you know, I've already taken too much of your time, but I promise you they're my babies. They're coming up in 5 minutes. So then she walked away. Then when Sarah came with the babies, I found her outside. She was like talking to her friends. I don't know what's wrong with me, man. I was just like jacked. I just interrupted. Like, these are my babies.
You know what? You're like, this could be my one shot. I'm going to make her.
Yeah, I don't care. I'm too old, dude. I just don't care anymore, right? Like, I don't get intimidated.
It works, though. It works.
She blew on him, and this is the best part. Ibu was like, gave zero Fs. Couldn't care less. He's like, this is Chimamanda, auntie. And he's like, I want dude. And then he turned away. And then she was like, this is the universe humbling me. And then...